Well, good evening, everyone. So this week I'm talking about the title of the lecture is Beyond Art, Georges Bataille and Document. This document ran for 2 years, 1929-1930. Inside this plain yellow cover, with its banner heading and these four epistemological labels, Doctrine, Archaeology, Beaux-Arts, Ethnography, was an explosive visual mix of heterogeneous things, ethnographic objects, archaeological remains, Cycladic figures, Chinese bronzes, sculpture, contemporary painting, photography, popular icons, film, crime, and detective novels, together with articles by the foremost ethnographic and anthropological specialists in France and Germany, articles by dissident surrealist writers and poets, and articles by Georges Bataille. It was described by the former surrealist and future ethnographer Michel Leiris as a war machine against accepted ideas. It occupies an important position in the intellectual and cultural history of the 20th century. It was not the voice of a specific group, like the surrealist journals such as La Révolution Surréaliste, but it was rather a crossroads of ideas about art, civilization, material culture, the primitive and the sacred. And it was the inspiration for James Clifford's very important and influential concept of ethnographic surrealism. It also carried on an aggressive dialogue with Breton and the Orthodox surrealists, who were, in the pages of Document, routinely characterized as evasive and utopian idealists. The list on the cover, which was firstly, as I said, doctrine, exactly what that meant is something of an interesting question. Archaeology, Beaux-Arts, Ethnography was changed from the fourth issue. Doctrine disappears from the top of the list and is replaced at the bottom by Variété. And Variété seems particularly to have covered shows, spectacles, and various different kinds of popular pursuits. Now, you'll see on the left-hand screen, which is actually upside down, sorry about that, the cover of an exhibition that we organised at the Hayward Gallery in 2006 called Undercover Surrealism. And part of what I want to talk about today is the problem of how you can translate something like a magazine, like Document, into an exhibition. The kinds of problems that arise. Really, the origins of this idea of making an exhibition around Document goes back actually 30 years to an exhibition called Dada and Surrealism Reviewed that I was involved in at the also Hayward Gallery in 1978. And at that exhibition, surrealist works of art, objects, chosen objects, books were organised in relation to a specific review magazine. So there was a room of La Révolution Surréaliste, a room of Minotaur, and so on. We weren't sure whether to include Document or not, and so we went to see Michel Leiris in Paris and said, well, what about this? Because it's not really, you know, Bataille was on the fringes, but also kind of enemy of surrealism. Should we include it? He said, oh yes, absolutely, you should certainly include it. And I thought that that was actually the last final sort of push against Breton and the Surrealists, because after that exhibition, which included Document, and after Document and Bataille were beginning to arouse a lot of attention, the shift was really very notable of interest from Breton to Bataille. And in a way, the story of Surrealism has recently been told in terms of a kind of battle between them, with Bataille usually winning. That is, in a sense, a sort of contemporary take on it. Now, I'm not going to dwell too much on that. I just wanted to give that background. But ever since then, ever since that exhibition, where the room of Document stood out, and it was quite extraordinary, it was very strong, very unusual, didn't quite belong anywhere, and I've always wanted, ever since then, to do an exhibition Document. So Undercover Surrealism finally took place in 2006 at the Hayward Gallery. And everything in the exhibition was something reproduced in the pages of Document. And it was an extraordinary chase and research to try and track all these things down. Now, what I want to do, just to show you one thing, that one artist dominates in Document, and that is Picasso. And there's a whole issue devoted to Picasso, including this painting, and I shall come back to this particular painting at the end. But what I want to do now is to mimic in a way what we tried to do in the catalogue of Undercover Surrealism, and that is start off with a kind of taster of what the magazine looks like. So I'm just going to run through an extraordinarily heterogeneous set of pictures. Obviously, it's very selective, but it's an attempt to show you the range of things that Bataille included there. So, modern artists, and this is Picasso's patron model, sort of pin-up photographs of buxom ladies and also pin-up photographs of actors, whose sort of ludicrous appearance was something that Document put great interest in. A juxtaposition of, these are actual pages from Document, juxtaposition of two paintings by Salvador Dalí, bathers on the bottom left and the female bather on the bottom right. Below, an anamorphic painting, an anonymous anamorphic painting of St. Anthony of Padua and the infant Christ, which you can actually only see if you put your face right at the far side of the screen. It's in that sense, it's a distorted image, and it only begins to make sense when you see it from the side. Now, I never thought I would find that picture, and it turned up quite by chance at Sotheby's a few months before the exhibition, so we should include it. But the idea there, I think, was picking up on the distortion that Dalí operates on the body, suggesting there's something anamorphic, a kind of distorted perspective in the Dalí. Photographs commissioned, usually I think by Bataille, from the photographer Jacques-André Boiffard. This is one of the big toes that he did to accompany an article by Bataille called Le Gros Orteil, the big toe, which I shall be coming back to. And it's a full-page photograph, in other words, larger than life. Quite a lot of images of Fox Follies and Hollywood movies. And I just want to draw your attention to something else very striking about the kind of the visual language of Document, the way things are organised and put together, that there are quite often very striking visual analogies across the pages, some of which seem to make some sort of deliberate sense, and some of which are just confusing. So just notice those legs cut off by the curtain at the bottom. And it's placed a couple of pages before this photograph by Elie Lothar, which accompanied an article on The Slaughterhouse by Bataille. And there are others like that, so the half legs. And you think, well, what is going on here? So Document is working its visual images very, very hard. And they're often extremely powerful. So as well as the heterogeneity of the material, there is a sort of a visual argument going on. Photograph of an icy river at the top of the Neva, and another of the Hollywood scenes. And that little scene there is from a film that we included in the first room of the exhibition, which I hope to be able to show you later on. Again, you know, deliberate or not, there is a striking similarity between this group of Chinese bronzes from the David Weil collection in Paris and the Giacometti sculptures. It's not actually made explicit, but you become accustomed to a set of parallels that you're being invited to make, and you're being invited to think about, and invited to wonder about. A great deal of of ethnographic material as well as archaeological material. This is a photograph which I was unable to track down, sadly, of a child, a girl, sitting on one of the heads of a northwest coast Indian carving, extraordinary photograph. Quite a number of photographs of the northwest coast, the poles, carved poles, that often brought into connection, you know, running beside these sort of parallels I was talking about, utter contrasts, some things that seem to be completely disconnected. So a page of Fontimas covers beside it. Ekoi mask, and then other masks of a contemporary kind. This is one of the illustrations, again by Boifard, for an article by Lambour called Aeschylus and the Carnival Mask. And I think they're also actually funny. You know, I mean, there is a kind of, you know, slightly hysterical quality to them. If you do turn the pages of Document, you will find yourself sort of bursting out laughing every now and again because of the sort of shocking and startling nature of some of these things. A very important article by Georges Bataille on what he thought were Gnostic gems. This one, which is blown up here very large, is actually a couple of centimetres big, tiny little plaster thing. Sculptures from Afghanistan, from the Kabul Museum. I don't know if they're still there. Strange pages, sort of comic pages like this one, a sort of collage, a pre-surrealist collage from a book called What is Life? A group from the Ivory Coast with wearing masks. This was a particular people that was visited in the course of the Dakar-Djibouti mission that was a very major anthropological ethnographic expedition that several of the Document contributors went on, and was really, I mean, really sort of was the source for so much of the ethnographic material that is now in Paris. And the final issue, the number 8, 1930, is entirely dedicated to heads, but none of them are straightforward heads. They are truncated heads, or they're skulls, or they're kind of divine heads. And this particular one is one of the mortuary chapels in Rome, which the monks, getting fed up with the sort of many, many, many bones lying about of their deceased colleagues, decided to turn them into decoration. So all those decorations, the ceiling decorations, are bones, tibia, and skulls, and so on. And the final image, this is the correct way up. In other words, she's inverted. Again, by Boifard, of a very, very beautiful photograph. And that's the last image in the whole magazine. And I think there is a sense that it is a sort of whole. It has a beginning and an end. And this is an end. And so in a way, trying to make an exhibition around it could take that as a sort of starting point. Though I didn't organise the rooms by issue, I organised them by ideas drawn from Bataille's writings. Okay, so this is the page again, and you can see I just wanted to name some of the people who were on the editorial committee, because the background to this magazine, how it started, is really very interesting. There were several people from the Trocadéro, the old ethnographic museum, the Trocadéro, Dr. Rivet and Georges-Henri Rivière, very important. Karl Einstein is a German critic who was brought in by Wildenstein, and Wildenstein himself, there, George Wildenstein, was the financial backer for Document, and he was also the director of the Gazette des Beaux-Arts. And I'll come back to that in a moment. And so Bataille is named as the Secretary General. I think in the course of Document, in the course of the magazine, The apparently distinct categories on the cover become kind of blurred. As Professor Rivet said, he was an ethnographer specialising in pre-Columbian America and the founder of the Musée de l'Homme in the mid-1930s. And he wrote in the third issue of Document, the boundaries between these sciences, ethnography, archaeology, prehistory, are absolutely artificial. All are geared towards the study of man, and Rivet's approach was evolutionary and diffusionist. His ideal Musée de l'Homme, Museum of Mankind, actually belonged to the era of the Popular Front, 1936-7, and survived Bataille's pessimistic view of humankind, which is threaded through the pages of Document. Now, this is the first article that Bataille contributed to Document, the academic horse. Now, Document was split from the start, as Charles Miller writes in his essay on archaeology in the catalogue of the Undercover Surrealism exhibition. It was split in terms of Bataille's own proclivities. On the one hand, the transgressive, erotic, and excessive, and on the other, the scholarly and scientific. As a numismatist, he worked in the Cabinet des Médailles at the Bibliothèque Nationale, where at the time of Document, he wrote some of his most aggressive anti-idealist texts, such as The Language of Flowers or The Human Face, on the backs of reading tickets. And I think that some of the pages of Story of the Eye were also written on Cabinet des Médailles stationery. Document was also split between the academic contributors and the unclassifiable writers, many of them former surrealists such as Robert Desnos and Michel Léris, who, like Bataille, were pushing at the margins of art, sociology, philosophy, and anthropology. So Bataille was probably recommended to Wildenstein because of a recent, very much admired scholarly article that he wrote on coins from Central Asia. The promotional pamphlet for the new magazine announced that in Document, the most irritating, as yet unclassified works of art and certain heterogeneous, hitherto neglected productions will be the object of studies as rigorous, as scientific, as those of archaeologists. Now, it's still just possible to see that description from Wildenstein's point of view as a scholarly enterprise, addressing rare and unfamiliar works of primitive art with possibly some folk art thrown in. Bataille's first article, this one, The Academic Horse, immediately shattered the illusion. The Academic Horse, on the classical Greek representation of the horse and its degeneration on the coins of the Gauls, sets a tone at odds with academic objectivity. You notice the illustrations here. There's the very fine and ideally proportioned horse on the left-hand side, and then it begins to disappear as it's repeatedly copied and ends up as a kind of spider or monster on the right-hand side. So drawing attention to what he describes as the debased forms on the Gallic coins, like spiders or monsters, Bataille draws a comparison between the so-called barbaric and civilized peoples in which the values attached to each are inverted. I quote, "The absurdities of barbaric peoples exist in contradiction with arrogant academic certainties. Nightmares in contradiction with geometries, the monster horse with the academic horse." And we see here the origins of Bataille's notion of the anform or the formless. I will just read this because it's such an important short text from the critical dictionary in Document. "A dictionary begins when it no longer gives the meaning of words but their tasks. Thus, formless is not only an adjective having a given meaning, but a term that serves to bring things down in the world, generally requiring that each thing have its form. What it designates has no rights in any sense, and gets itself squashed everywhere, like a spider or a worm. In fact, for academic men to be happy, the universe has to take shape. All of philosophy has no other goal. It is a matter of giving a frock coat to what is, a mathematical frock coat. On the other hand, affirming that the universe resembles nothing, is only formless, amounts to saying that the universe is something like a spider or spit. So, against order and against authority, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Now, a member of the editorial board, also from the Cabinet des Médailles, objected to Bataille's article on the academic horse, and he wrote to him, "The title you have chosen for this review is justified only in the sense that it gives us documents on your state of mind. It's essential to return to the spirit which inspired us in the first project for the review, when you and I talked about it with Monsieur Dildenstein." Now, Bataille was determined that Document should not become, as Dildenstein probably hoped it would, a Gazette des Beaux-Arts Primitifs. It's also clear that he and the ethnographers associated with the review wanted to distance themselves from the primitivizing taste of the time, of the lure of the exotic. And this, I think, takes two forms in Document. On the one hand, the rigorous analysis of different civilizations separated in space and time, and on the other, by bringing our own culture, Hollywood for instance, in juxtaposition with each other to render them unfamiliar and to provoke the unexpected. Now, Document wasn't the only journal in the 20s that offered a mixture of contemporary non-Western art, architecture, film and music. One of them, which is actually quite close to Document in a way, was jazz. This was founded by the woman explorer, Titaina, and the two magazines advertised each other and had some of the same contributors. However, I think that jazz subscribed to a stereotyped view of the primitive. For example, it published this special issue on the exotic, it filled with examples of so-called primitive sculpture, just before Document began. This is a... I just have to show you this, because she seems to have been completely slipped out of the history of the 20th century journals. Titaina, who was a woman explorer, and she's there dressed in a leather jacket, which she used to go off on her jaunts around Asia and America. And this is a page which advertises, page from Jazz, which advertises Document. You see, Doctrine, Archaeology, Beaux-Arts, Ethnography. And it says that it's the encyclopedia of the 20th century, presented according to new methods, and it's the sum of all past and current research in all the fields of the mind. I think there might be a slight parody there, but that's what it's suggesting Document was. The deputy director of the Trocadéro Museum, Georges-Henri Rivière, asked in the first issue of Document what the new Trocadéro, the new Museum of Ethnography, which was planned, what it should be. One direction was offered by the elite taste for the so-called primitive, and I quote, "In the wake of our latest poets, artists, and musicians, the favour of the elite is turning towards the art of peoples reputed to be primitive and savage. An imperious but versatile taste awards beauty certificates to the Maliolo mannequin, to a Congo ivory, a Vancouver mask, while the stone capitals at Bezalay and Greek marbles are relegated to the admiration of old fogies. The Trocadéro could, therefore, have built itself on this counter-ethnography and become a museum of fine arts, a museum of Beaux-Arts Primitifs, where the objects would be arranged according to a single aesthetic. This would, he argues, be a very poor principle, as it would reveal very limited aspects of the objects in question. For Rivière, as for Rivet, the collections needed research and explanation and should include European folk art and craft." Georges-Henri Rivière also did contribute an essay to Jazz called The Folklore of Ethnography. And this is about the end of the old Trocadéro Museum, which he was overseeing. He was overseeing the modernization of the museum. And this is a kind of a very curious meditation on the old museum. In the museum in whose dusty and deserted rooms, Picasso and Derain had discovered African sculpture. The exotic, Rivière writes, that he wants to record before it goes forever, is that of a certain type of ethnographic museum, about to be swept away in the great modernizing program. Badly lit, the wax figures of different physical and racial types shrouded or dilapidated, eaten by moth and rust, the old Trocadero offered as picturesque and exotic a sight as anything in the Trobriand Islands. "Goodbye," he writes, "the Pyrenees is of the dark." The old Trocadero should have been kept as an historic monument, the last witness of an ancient genre, the folklore of ethnography. And I think building on that particular article and the notion of this dust-covered museum, Bataille chose to reproduce photographs of these mannequins stacked up and now useless, unwanted, the ones that used to show different costumes of tribes and so on in the museum, together with a little article on dust. And it's very interesting how often Bataille is actually responding to something that happened in one of the other magazines, such as Cahiers d'Art or Jazz. Now, in the disputed area of art and the ethnographic object, the question of authenticity was a major cause of disagreement, both with regard to aesthetic response and to the issue of an object untouched by the colonial culture. Karl Einstein, who wrote the important but quite puzzling book Negerplastique, in 1915, mourned the loss of an intact sculptural vision in African art because of the colonial invasions. Not only did he attempt to speak purely of sculptural form, so that some thought it a study of sculpture as such, not of African sculpture, he also was wholly uninterested in the kinds of inquiry pursued by ethnographers. And I quote, "We will bracket out subject matter and the contextual associations related to it, and instead analyse these objects as formal constructs." However, in Document, he did write about an Ekoi ritual dance mask, that's this one. In fact, it's a Janus-faced mask, which he said are of a terrifying naturalism. But he was completely detached from the side of Document that was interested in variété and in contemporary culture, except for painting. Marcel Briot, on the other hand, criticizes purists and collectors of primitive art for denying the large primitive public the right to employ the new objects imported by the colonialists. Apparently there was an objection to the wooden drum from the Ivory Coast, which I show you a detail here, because it represented a gun. Anything that showed any sort of contamination from the culture of the West was, according to some of the sort of purists and collectors in Paris, absolutely unacceptable. "It is grotesque," Briel says, "to call it impure, because it represents this European artifact." And Griot protests by turning the situation around. If a black artist cannot, without demeaning himself, use an exotic element, i.e. European, that he knows, what should we think about our blind borrowings from a world exotic to us, which in our own defence we insist we know nothing about? From every quarter in Document, the conventions and values underpinning Western culture are called into question. Within the ethnographic context, this took the form of turning the critical gaze onto their own world, the juxtaposition of modern popular culture, film and art with the objects of African, Oceanic and other civilizations, operated, as James Clifford has argued, like surrealist collage. Ethnographic surrealist practice, in his words, and he was taking Document as his model, attacks the familiar, provoking the eruption of otherness of the unexpected. This is to turn the methodological assumptions of ethnography on their head, rather than rendering the different, exotic, familiar, by the processes of naming, classifying, describing, and interpreting, according to well-meaning criteria derived from the known. Document provoked unsettling studies of the West's own rituals and habits, suggesting we know less than we think about our civilization and human nature in general. This is a page celebrating the arrival of Lou Leslie's Blackbirds in Paris, which Bataille and Leris were absolutely enchanted by. It's also a very loaded pair of images on the right-hand side. You've got the arrival of the Blackbird's troop at the bottom on a ship called the France, and the garrison of a penitentiary in New Caledonia above it. And you're invited to sort of think about why these two are put in juxtaposition with each other. What is going on? Why is this the case? And I think, although I'm not trying to suggest that Document is tremendously ahead of its time in terms of an anti-colonialist state of mind, I think there is something there about contrasting, you know, what is exported, that is, this sort of penitentiary and a certain kind of justice, if you like, to the colonies, but what is imported is art and music. The very concept of civilization, which is constantly put to work in the use of the terms primitive or primitivizing, is in question. As Leiris wrote in his text Civilization, civilization could be compared to the layer of green scum that settles on still waters. All our moral habits, polite customs, all that brightly coloured cloak that veils the crudity of our dangerous instincts, all those lovely forms of culture we're so proud of, for it's thanks to this that we call ourselves civilized, can vanish at the slightest turbulence, break up at the slightest shock, revealing in the cracks terrifying savagery. In this article, Civilization, Leiris then sets about undermining pride in European civilization from another perspective. Not only is the veneer thin, but the capacity of the European imagination is feeble and sclerotic. So, writing about the Blackbirds, he says, what is beautiful about such art is not its exotic aspect, nor even its highly modern content. This modernism is simply coincidental. But the fact that it doesn't really constitute an art at all. Reviews like the Blackbirds take us to a point on the other side of art, to a point of development at which that bastard son of the illegitimate love of magic and free play has not yet been hypertrophied, implying that art, as it were, which still retained magic and free play, has atrophied in the West, but it has not atrophied there. And so it's a notion that it's something on the other side of art, not what we necessarily think automatically is art. There's a question of what, you know, that is a concept that is under question. Now, I'm going to look very briefly at a sequence of articles by Bataille addressing particular ideas or images, which I then use as the basis for the exhibition. This here, on the right-hand side, is a page from Document, showing the tiny little glass figures which were put inside passion bottles from Notre-Dame de Liesse. These passion bottles, it's passion in the sense of religion, and not in the sense of erotic passion, contained holy water. And they were collector's items. And so I managed to find some of these in the museum that Rivière had founded in Paris, the Musée des Arts Ecclésiastiques Populaires, these very glass bottles that are reproduced in Document. And these are tiny little glass things that represent the crucifixion or Judas or Christ or angels. And I think they rise up and down according to the temperature of the water, but that's another point. Bataille and Leiris went to Notre-Dame de Liesse to investigate what they call the Saint-Sulpicerie. Saint-Sulpice is the church in Paris which produces most objects associated with devotion and the Catholic faith. And they were going to write an article about this as a pilgrimage site, but it was censored by Wildenstein, who found it too sacrilegious. So that's, we never know what they were going to say about it. But Bataille compares this as a site of pilgrimage with Hollywood and says that Hollywood really is now our true place of pilgrimage. It's the place where we throw money at the goddesses and, you know, it's similarly decked out in tinsel and gems. Another article by Bataille is called The Language of Flowers, and this is illustrated with these extraordinary photographs by Carl Blossfeldt, which are close-ups, enormously magnified photographs of parts of flowers, stamens, pistils, and so on, which was intended as partly as a teaching aid for his students, but also obviously of scientific interest. And Bataille completely distorts the purpose of these photographs, and he talks about them as the title of the essay is The Language of Flowers. And he's saying, what is the language of flowers? Well, red roses for love, for example. And then he says, well, actually, it's very appropriate that the rose should be chosen, the flower should be chosen as the symbol of human love and devotion, because roses fade so fast and turn very quickly into tatters of aerial manure. So it's his way of turning the notion of the language of flowers around, so that rather than being this ideal symbol, because the symbol, as it were, is symbolising something that is not ideal, then the substitution of this hairy inside of the flower, that I felt was appropriate. I'm trying to give you the sort of flavour of the sort of really unclassifiable essays that Bataille contributed to Document. So Language of Flowers is one of them. The Big Toe, I've shown you one of the three illustrations from this article already. In The Big Toe, again, Bataille sets out to really undermine our fixed categories of high and low, base and ideal, and so on. And he says that the big toe is that part of the human anatomy that distinguishes us most clearly from the anthropoid ape, our nearest relative otherwise, and it is the thing that is anchored most firmly in the mud. So you get the idea that if he's trying to suggest that that mankind is not necessarily, as it were, entirely dedicated to the noble and the ideal. Another of his essays, this is a little critical dictionary entry, on the slaughterhouse, this photograph accompanies, is the partner of the one I showed you earlier on, with the very neatly stacked up calves' legs. So there's a contrast between the hygienic appearance, kind of swept clean appearance, of the slaughterhouse from the outside, which is what that photograph showed you, and the complete chaos, the repellent mess of the inside of the slaughterhouse. And his argument in his dictionary entry, catalogue dictionary, is that slaughterhouses are nowadays tucked away in remote parts of a town, that nobody knows really where they are, nobody knows where their food comes from, nobody knows where the abattoirs are. And that's because we can't face the sight, as it were, of the blood that still, you know, supports our cities and our civilization. And he says that there was a time, though, when temples were both slaughterhouses and places of worship. And so he's kind of very interested in looking at what has happened to the slaughterhouse in modern culture. Base materialism, narcissism, a different kind of article this time, because it purports to be addressing a proper sort of archaeological area, these very, very strange Gnostic gems. What he's interested in here is the fact that they seem to him to be representing an ideal god of goodness and light, but gods of darkness and evil. This is not necessarily how we think of them nowadays, but that's how Bataille is thinking about them. So, for Bataille, art should not offer the illusion of harmony and comfort. In his final essay in the last issue of Document, while it was under his control, there was a completely uninteresting continuation in the early 1930s. The essay called The Modern Spirit and the Game of Transpositions, he explores his twin theme of the of the craven human and the powerlessness of the work of art, to the accompaniment of illustrations of the skull-decorated mortuary chapels in Rome, close-ups of the eye of a fly, and flypaper, of which this is one. And I quote, "What one truly loves, one loves in shame. And I defy any lover of painting to love a canvas as much as a fetishist loves a shoe. For painting, in Bataille's view, to be on the level of the human condition, it has to be stupefyingly ugly, incoherent, or bound." And this painting by Miro, I'm not saying this is how I feel these paintings should be looked at. I'm simply giving you an example of how they were looked at by Bataille. This is a very stunning painting. I mean, it is an extraordinarily minimal work. But you could see it just, in a sense, almost as like pure painting. It's very, very powerful. It's quite large. Bataille wrote of these that Miro begins with the representation of objects so meticulous that at a certain point, this is the text I'm reading you here, a certain point they turn reality to dust, a sort of sunlit dust. Subsequently, these tiny objects individually liberate themselves from all reality and disappear as a throng of decomposed elements which are also a lot more agitated. Finally, as Miro himself professed to want to kill painting, the decomposition was pushed to such a point that nothing else remained but a few formless stains, on the lid, or the tombstone, if you prefer, of the box of tricks. The little angry and alienated elements proceeded to a new eruption before once more disappearing today into these paintings, leaving only the traces of who knows what disaster. So I'm just going to look at three artists in relation to Bataille. Miro and Dali. This painting we've already seen very briefly. It's called The Lugubrious Game, Le Jeu Lugubre. This is halfway through 1929. Dali is the hottest property in Paris, and everybody really wants him on their side. Bataille wants him for Document. He's one of the first people to write about Jean Dalou in the pages of Document. But Dali has decided that really his best interests will be served by signing up with Breton and the Surrealists, because they really can command more sort of gallery space, basically, I think. And so when Bataille asked Dali if he could reproduce the Jeu du Louvre in the magazine, Dali said no, because nobody could collaborate on both magazines. You couldn't be a member of the Surrealist group and also a member of the Document circle. So instead of reproducing the painting, Bataille reproduced a sketch that he made of it, in which he interprets the painting in very strictly psychoanalytical terms. He sees it, he talks about the degraded appearance of the couple on the bottom right-hand side, the torn body in the centre, which is in fragments, in pieces, which sweep up through the canvas. Dali's own head is in the centre with the nose pointing downwards, and above it, as it were, as if the head has opened up, things are floating out of it. Now, Bataille sees it as a painting about castration, about violence, about fear. And he's deliberately pitting himself against the way that Breton wrote about this painting in the preface to the catalogue of the 1929 exhibition at the Gomes Gallery. And Breton wrote that with this painting, with these paintings of Dali, the windows of the mind open wide for the first time, but the sort of freedom and that Breton sees them in a completely different way as a form of liberation. What's actually quite interesting, from the point of view of some things I'll be talking about later on in the lectures, is that both of them miss the fact that there is considerable gender ambiguity in this painting. The figure on the statue, for example, who has a sort of ossified penis, is actually dressed in a robe. And the torn figure is actually not male, probably, but female. So So there are, I mean, this is actually a painting of great complexity, and one I'll come back to. But the point really is that Bataille made a great point of insisting on its ugliness. And he said, without any preamble, I will say that Picasso's paintings are hideous, and those by Dalí are of a terrifying ugliness. Well, I'm going to end, though I hope not completely end, because I hope we're going to be able to see a little bit of the film of the exhibition, with this painting by Picasso, which was reproduced in Document. Now, Michel Méris, writing about Picasso in Document, there was a special issue devoted to him, insists on the opposition between Picasso and Surrealism's sort of poetic evasions, its belief in the reconciliation of contradictory states like dream and waking. Méris musters a materialist critique of Picasso's paintings, which is a good, if not complete, position from which to look at some of those in the special issue on Picasso. As well as the phrase down to earth, Méris contrasts Picasso's new objects and new combinations of forms, which are the most concrete, the most dense, the most living, with phantoms, monsters, and the surhumain. Picasso, by contrast with the surrealists, Méris says, stands on the ground, sets them upright, stands things on the ground, sets them upright, knows the exact weight of things and their materiality. Now, this painting, which is now known as Woman in an Armchair, was reproduced in Document without a title, like the vast majority of his recent works. Identification was via date, size, and occasionally medium. But inscribed on the stretcher on the back of this painting is the word Metamorphosis. And this was the title of Picasso's first maquettes for the monument to Apollinaire of 1927-28. Apollinaire had died in 1918. The immediate impression of this painting is of frontality, an upright figure, solid, severe, and monumental, a construction of precision with clean lines and reduced palette. The longer one looks, the less secure this response becomes, or rather it repeatedly shatters and returns. The figure seems to be one of the least human of Picasso's women, and appears to be poised on the edge of something other than a chair, apparently a hollow grey box. The two strong red curves of the chair frame, but do not embrace, the woman wedge, although there's a shadow behind the ball joint or stomach here, there, which is the only softness in the whole painting, the only thing that's not sort of hard, even surface. The right-hand sweep of paint elegantly matches the arm of the chair and is thus angled away from the viewer, and it's a shriller and lighter red than that on the left. This is flat and indicates a chair of a different scale to the body. The upper edge of the left red band exactly meets the junction here, the junction of the background, the white face and grey torso, thus neatly summarising the overall impression of interlocking planes. But how these four planes, red, black, white, and grey, here, actually are oriented spatially in relation to each other is highly ambiguous. If you take the white shape that I've referred to as a face, the erect stance of the central figure, this sort of phallic woman, emphasised by the downward-pointing wedge shape, inclines one to read this as vertical, with the holes one above another. Picasso not infrequently stacks eyes vertically in an upright profile face, so this doesn't seem too odd. However, it also reads as a face or mask turned sideways and upwards, the eye holes therefore now anatomically correct, so the face is turned on its side. Read at this angle, the grey arc rising from the red chair arm to meet one of the angles of the white face could be the woman's left arm raised over and supporting her head, as in so many of the women in an armchair. Seen either way, the two perforations, that's those I've referred to as eyes, are quite unlike the dots, lines, almond shapes or black smudges that usually signify eye in Picasso's paintings. While the shifts at this period in Picasso's work between linear and volumetric, even within a single sketchbook, are well known, these holes are unusual. With other monumental figures, eyes are drawn on the surface or are integrated into the form itself as if eroded. Here, they reveal the white face mask as hollow, with a thick skin surface through which they've been punched. Or they're the absence of eyes, as in a skull. The blackness within and behind the holes is painted with circular brush strokes, which contrast with the other black areas on the canvas, and cannot read as identical with the background or with the shadow chair back. If the whole thing was see-through, the lower hole would in fact give onto the red chair. It has to be interior to the form, thus prompting us to see it as a skull. Haunted as this and other works by Picasso at the time are by the problem of the Apollinaire monument, the demand to commemorate the poet who was probably his greatest friend, the face of death seems to preside here. The lower curve of the flat white face is capped by a two-tone, light and dark grey triangular shape. And this momentarily appears to read either as concave, that's this wedge here, either as concave or convex, but it's abruptly fixed at the bottom here as a pointed wedge with a low, sharp end. Any doubt about this is scotched by the way it overlaps the hollow ball joint on which it rests. And there's no resolution. There's rather an indecisive reunion, a conjunction of incompatible shapes, inexhaustibly fascinating, that keep one looking, in a manner reminiscent of the great Cubist pictures, where the surface constantly intrudes and impinges on attempts patiently to construct consistent forms. Here, it is as though the metamorphosis that might be the picture's subtitle is visibly performed through the paint. This is another level of metamorphosis, shape-shifting, over and above the classic Circean transformation of men into swine or Jovian bulls into gods into bulls or swans. A form visibly shifts and alters under one's eyes and contradicts itself. The alterations in the way we read the grey plains or the white in Woman in an Armchair are not clear alternatives. They hover between indecisions, though in such a very strikingly confident way, in a thoroughly paradoxical manner, destroying any fixity of meaning. And Bataille put this, I think, what I've tried to see in this painting, he put this in its larger context, and I quote, "When Picasso paints, the dislocation of forms drags with it the dislocation of thought. That is to say that the immediate intellectual movement, which in other cases leads to ideas, aborts. The idea for Bataille in his document texts, anti-Hegelian, anti-philosophy, is restrictive, authoritarian, abstract, and its abortion was thus a kind of freedom." Okay, I was hoping to be able to show you one section from the exhibition Undercover Surrealism, whose rooms were arranged, as I said, according to some of the governing ideas of Bataille's and in relation to some of the artists that appear in Document. A room of Picasso, there was Dali, Miro, and the first room was called Places of Pilgrimage. And the idea was to show museum objects in relation to other kind of ritual objects and contemporary paintings like Picasso's The Dancers. So I think you're welcome to leave, but you're also welcome to stay. We'll play it. And there is music with it, because the exhibition included music, jazz, Stravinsky, and contemporary music, and also film. So at the very end of this little sequence, you see a film of from the Hollywood Review. It's this little piece is about 6 minutes long. It's a bit long, so I'm warning you. There. So that was the first room of the exhibition and the film. what greeted you when you came in. And at the end of the film, Buster Keaton appears. It's actually a comic film. So trying to somehow play with humour, with nostalgia, with violence, with the erotic, and in this extraordinary heterogeneous collection of things was quite difficult. And I think many people came in were puzzled by the first film, but gradually it made more sense as we went around the whole exhibition. People tend to start again from there. But thank you very much.